KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. What do constantly changing tariff rates mean for the economy? China just raised its tariffs after U.S. tariffs climbed several times in a few days. We talk it over with Kai Rizdal on Morning Edition from NPR News. The House approved a budget blueprint which is expected to include cuts to Medicaid. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. It also requires a lot more government debt. So how did Speaker Mike Johnson sell lawmakers who say they're fiscally conservative? Also, what's it do to you when you lose a good job? Layla interviews John Hamm, who plays a hedge fund manager gone wrong. It's Friday, April 11th. This day in 1951, President Harry Truman fired General Douglas MacArthur, who had been publicly advocating a different strategy against China in the Korean War. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. China has again retaliated for President Trump's latest tariffs on imported Chinese products. This week, Trump boosted U.S. tariffs on Chinese goods to 145%. China says it's now increasing its tariffs on U.S. products to 125%. Some lawmakers are insisting on a greater role for Congress in President Trump's trade actions. Indiana Republican Senator Todd Young says he wants more clarity on what Trump is doing. But he points out there are security issues at stake, too. Young says U.S. pharmaceutical companies rely on China for many active ingredients they put into their medications.
They are able to threaten to withhold these inputs into our manufacturing economy. That undermines our health security, and it could conceivably undermine our national security if we were in a time of conflict. So I know that's why President Trump is determined to reorder our trade relations with China so that we can become more resilient and avoid these things in the future.
He spoke to NPR's Morning Edition. Democratic members of two independent agencies protecting workers' rights have once again been removed from their seats. This time it's due to an order from Chief Justice John Roberts. NPR's Andrea Hsu reports.
The two members are Gwen Wilcox of the National Labor Relations Board and Kathy Harris of the Merit Systems Protection Board. President Trump fired both in the first few weeks of his administration. Wilcox and Harris sued, citing federal law and Supreme Court precedent that hold that they can only be fired for cause. Ever since, it's been a yo-yo of a legal battle. Twice already, judges have ordered them returned to their seats. But now, Chief Justice Roberts has temporarily halted those orders while the Supreme Court considers the Trump administration's formal request for a review of the lower court decisions. Without the two members, both boards lack a quorum, hampering some of their core functions. Andrea Hsu, NPR News.
The Trump administration is further backing off from a plan that would have required many Americans to travel to a Social Security field office for in-person service. NPR's Ashley Lopez reports the change was supposed to take effect Monday.
A spokesperson for the White House says in a statement to NPR that telephone services will continue for people seeking Social Security benefits. Last month, agency officials announced people would have to travel in person to a local office if they were unable to use the agency's online verification system. The policy would have effectively eliminated widely used telephone services for many beneficiaries. But White House officials say the agency's anti-fraud team has improved technological capabilities, allowing workers to identify fraud on claims over the telephone. Advocates are applauding the reversal, which came after intense public pressure against the proposed changes. Ashley Lopez, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR. Flood watches are still posted in much of western Kentucky, parts of Tennessee, and Arkansas. They were pummeled by powerful storms and tornadoes last week that poured historic amounts of rain. The National Weather Service says nearly 50 rivers are at moderate or major flood stage. That includes the Ohio River. It is crested at very high heights in Ohio, Indiana, and Kentucky. Colorado will soon have some of the strictest gun restrictions in the nation. From member station KUNC, Lucas Brady Woods has more.
A new Colorado law will make it illegal in the state to buy a wide range of guns without going through hours of training and getting a permit. Supporters say it will limit the damage inflicted during mass shootings. State Senator Tom Sullivan is behind the measure. His son was killed in one such attack at an Aurora, Colorado movie theater in 2012.
We can't afford not to do all we can to change the continuing impact of gun violence.
Gun dealers say the measure will do major damage to their businesses. Colorado's governor signed the law this week, but most of it won't take effect until next summer. For NPR News, I'm Lucas Brady Woods in Denver.
The marketing company Publishers Clearinghouse says it's going to file for bankruptcy protection. Publishers Clearinghouse is most famous for its Prize Patrol sweepstakes. Very surprised winners are often filmed being presented with oversized cardboard checks. The company says it's going to shift away from its legacy business of direct mail and retail merchandising and turn to digital advertising. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. Coming up, House Republicans rounded up the vote for extended tax cuts and a whole lot of borrowing.
First, we have an assessment of the week in trade. President Trump said he would not back off his tariffs, and then shortly after they took effect, he backed off many of them. The president also changed the tax rates that Americans pay on Chinese goods multiple times. So what does this week add up to? We're going to talk it through with Kai Ryssdal, who many of us hear in the evenings on Marketplace. Kai, good to hear you in the morning.
Hey, Steve, how are you?
I'm doing okay, thanks so much. What do you think about when you hear the tariff rate on Chinese goods is now 145%?
Well, I think the next move clearly is going to be infinity plus one, right? That's where
sure.
this is going. Overnight, the Chinese said, we'll see your 145 and we'll go 125 of our own. But they also said, if you're looking for a climb down on this one, which I think and hope everybody is, they also said, the U.S. moves are a joke and we're not going to respond anymore. So if there's a glimmer of hope, then that's it, right?
That's the glimmer of hope, that it's
yes.
a joke and we're not going to respond anymore? Oh, they're saying they're not going to raise their tariffs, but go on.
That's exactly right. They're saying we're done with this. And I think if you're looking for anything, that's what it's going to be. It's the Chinese saying we're done. We can't do this anymore unless you see what happens. Now, at 145% or infinity plus one, there is effectively going to be no trade between these two countries, which is really a bad thing because they're the first and second biggest economies in the world. Who knows what's going to happen? But I think if you're looking for a silver lining, that's the very small one.
Okay. People talk about decoupling between the U.S. and mm-hmm. China, which would be a convulsion. They've used that term for years. But is this real decoupling if these tariffs persist?
No, it's not. Look, the U.S. and Chinese trade relationship has built over decades. And it's folly to think that in the course of months or even weeks, the Trump administration is going to be able to decouple. Now, are there real structural problems with the trade relationships between the two countries? Absolutely. Absolutely. But I think what's going to have to happen is that over time, and this is a time span of years and maybe decades, which is how long it took to build up, that's what's going to have to happen. They're going to have to do it slowly and over time, not as the Trump administration seems to want to do in weeks and months.
So let's talk about, well, the rest of the world. The president backed down on tariffs for the rest of the world, leaving in place this 10% tariff, but the huge tariffs on places like Vietnam go away for 90 days.
Right.
I sat with a CEO just this week who was already, this is before the president backed down.
Yep.
The CEO was already acting like the recession is here, talking about a hiring freeze, preparing for layoffs, canceling leases, saving on expenses. That was before the president backed down for 90 days, the 90-day pause. What does that mean for business people who do global business?
It means uncertainty. It means we don't know from one day to the next what the president of the United States is going to do with the global economy. Let's think about what's happening here, right? The entire global economy is now subject to the whims of one guy, right? And he's known to change his mind mercurially, to be kind, right? So companies and consumers are looking at this and saying, well, look, maybe we're not going to be facing actual layoffs, but certainly hiring is going to pause. As you said, the CEO said capital expenditures, right? Investments are going to pause. And that eventually, as with everything in this economy, trickles down to the consumer. And so consumers are going to say, well, look, maybe I don't need to buy that new TV today. Maybe I need to wait and see what's going to happen. And when you have uncertainty and chaos, people don't do things. And economic activity slowing is another word for recession.
This was what we were hearing Thursday or Friday of last week when the president first announced the tariffs. People were saying, we're going to pause even shipping goods to America until we figure this out. It sounds like you're telling me that could last another 3 months minimum.
3 months minimum, because I'm going to say this again. We don't know what President Trump is going to do. And when you have that kind of, I'm shrugging here, nobody can see it, but when you have that kind of, I don't know, then everybody just sits and pauses. Look, that's what the Fed's going to do, too. The Fed looks at this and says, we don't know if prices are going higher. We don't know if growth is going to slow. So we're just going to sit here and do nothing, which for the Fed, for the central bank, is fine. For everybody else in this economy, to slow their economic activity is a very bad thing.
You sound skeptical of all this. So tell me what you would say to somebody in the American national security establishment who would say, as Senator Todd Young said to us in the other hour of the program, effectively, well, you know, there is a problem here. Someone needs to address it because China's a problem.
Yeah. So look, China really is a problem. And we can't emphasize that enough. There are deep structural problems. But the way to do it is not to try to do it in a week and a half or 2 months, right? This is going to take years and decades. So I would say now to people in positions of power, what are you doing? There is no plan right now. It's just chaos. And that is not good.
And that was Senator Young's other question was, what's the plan? Kai, thanks so much.
You bet. Good to talk to you, Steve.
Kai Ryssdal of Marketplace on American Public Media.
The Speaker of the House is starting his day on a win.
Republicans narrowly gained approval of their budget blueprint, which makes room for renewing President Trump's tax cuts as well as his border security policies. This plan also includes trillions of dollars in federal borrowing to finance those tax cuts and other things. Fiscal conservatives resisted that part but got a promise from party leaders to deliver spending cuts later. Speaker Mike Johnson says the real work begins now.
That was a big step because that will allow us now to move forward to have our committees actually drafting the one big beautiful bill.
NPR congressional correspondent Deirdre Walsh is with us now. Good morning, Deirdre.
Good morning, Michelle.
So as I understand it, House Speaker Mike Johnson didn't have the votes on Wednesday but got it through yesterday. So what happened? How did you manage it?
Well, he and Senate Majority Leader John Thune met separately with a group of about 20 conservatives who were adamant that the budget package had to include a minimum amount of spending cuts. They're talking $1.5 trillion. There's a range in this resolution, but these hardliners weren't convinced the Senate would actually meet the higher number, and now they say they are.
So what's in this blueprint?
It's really a big package that wraps the president's legislative agenda into one set of instructions for committees to follow. The resolution says the House and Senate agrees on these goals. Now they have to work out all the details. They've agreed they want more money for border security, domestic energy production. But most importantly, this budget extends the president's tax cuts. Those are going to expire at the end of 2025. That extension of those tax breaks is going to cost around $5.5 trillion over 10 years. Republicans are also planning to use this budget package to avoid a default on the nation's debt. They're going to raise the debt ceiling by about $5 trillion. By doing it in this budget package, they don't have to negotiate any concessions with Democrats. They're using a process to get around a Democratic filibuster. Democrats have been blasting this package. They're saying it's going to add trillions to the deficit. Some were calling it yesterday a heist with tax breaks for the wealthy as programs for the working class are expected to be slashed.
So about this $1.5 trillion in cuts, there's already discussion about a big chunk of those cuts coming from Medicaid, which is the health care program for low-income people, elderly people, and disabled people. Is that still the plan?
There is no doubt Medicaid is going to be a big source of savings in this budget. You cannot cut $1.5 trillion from the federal budget without getting some from the biggest side of the federal ledger. That's mandatory spending on programs like Medicaid. The process Republicans are using walls off any changes to Social Security. After the vote, the speaker was careful to say Medicaid beneficiaries aren't going to lose their coverage. He's arguing there's over $50 billion in waste, fraud, and abuse in the Medicaid program and other programs. The speaker emphasized they're going to make changes to Medicaid to add work requirements.
No one has talked about cutting one benefit in Medicaid to anyone who's duly owed. What we've talked about is returning work requirements. So, for example, you don't have able-bodied young men on a program that's designed for single mothers and the elderly and disabled.
Okay, so Republican leaders say they want to get the legislation with all the details to the president's desk by Memorial Day. Is that timeline doable?
This is going to be a huge lift for Republicans, and as you know, they have a really skinny majority in the House. Lawmakers in swing districts are really concerned about Medicaid, and conservatives want more than $1.5 trillion in cuts. They want closer to $2 trillion. But even some Republicans, like Missouri Republican Josh Hawley, are warning they're not going to vote for Medicaid cuts, and many working-class Trump voters rely on these programs, and they would be the ones hurt.
That is NPR's Deirdre Walsh. Deirdre, thank you.
Thank you.
6 people died when a helicopter crashed into the Hudson River in New York City yesterday. The victims have been identified, some of them. Siemens tech executive Augustin Escobar, his wife and their 3 children, and also the pilot who's not been named. WNYC's Julia Hayward has the story.
It was just after 3:15 p.m. when a tour helicopter plunged into the New Jersey side of the Hudson River, across from New York City. The aircraft had taken off from Manhattan's downtown Skyport. New York Police Department Commissioner Jessica Tisch spoke at a press conference.
The helicopter reached the George Washington Bridge and then turned again to fly south along the New Jersey shoreline. Shortly thereafter, the aircraft lost control and hit the water just a few feet off the coast of Pier A Park in Hoboken.
She also said 2 of the victims later died at a hospital in New Jersey. Eyewitness videos posted on social media appear to show the helicopter breaking apart midair. Video shows its rotors detaching from the cabin before spiraling downward and hitting the river with force. The NYPD Harbor Unit and the City Fire Department's Marine Division responded immediately, along with U.S. Coast Guard crews. Emergency divers pulled victims from the water. The Coast Guard confirmed that all 6 occupants were recovered. The National Transportation Safety Board said it is leading the investigation into what caused the crash. The FAA temporarily paused nearby air traffic in the hours following the incident. New York City Mayor Eric Adams offered his condolences to the victims' families and praised first responders.
Again, we're praying for the families and our gratitude to the rescuers and the courage that was displayed and their dedication.
Helicopter tours in New York City have long been a source of complaints from residents who cite constant noise and safety risks. Right after the incident, some lawmakers called for an outright ban on non-essential helicopters flying over Manhattan. The city council is weighing legislation that could eventually force tour operators to convert to quieter electric models or shut down altogether. For NPR, I'm Julia Hayward.
This is NPR News.
The hit series Hacks is back on HBO and Max. It follows the sharp, funny, and sometimes tense dynamic between an aging stand-up legend and a young comedy writer. On the next Fresh Air, we'll talk with stars Gene Smart and Hannah Einbinder, as well as Paul W. Downs, who co-created, co-wrote, and stars in the show. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Linda Moodbell Learning Centers, one-to-one instruction to help students catch up or get ahead. Online or in-person instruction for reading, comprehension, and math. LindaMoodbell.com/NPR. From Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool so drivers can see coverage options, at Progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. From Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, working to shorten the gap between cancer research and cancer care. Learn more about Dana-Farber's momentum of discovery at DanaFarber.org/everywhere. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at MacFound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel. A new streaming series considers how far the wealthy might go to keep up appearances. John Hamm plays Coop, a hotshot hedge fund manager. He's lost his wife to divorce, and now he's lost his job.
I was thinking about alimony, child support, legal fees, two houses, a maxed out home equity line, tuition.
With no money coming in, Coop decides to break into the mansions in his neighborhood and steal his friend's stuff.
I'm not saying it was a good idea. It was just temporary. A quick fix to pay some bills until I got back on my feet. And I figured, what's the worst that could happen?
The unraveling of Coop is at the heart of Your Friends and Neighbors, now streaming on Apple TV+. John Hamm says, by all accounts, Coop did everything right, up until the point we meet him.
Getting to this place means so much, and then we realize that it can evaporate in seemingly an instant. Another character says to him at some point, you know, your mistake was thinking that any of this was ever truly yours. Mm. And that's another, you know, kind of theme of the show of like, if all of this stuff is so ephemeral, then why do we ascribe so much meaning to it? And does it in fact really mean anything? Does it define us?
So as one does, Coop goes from hedge fund manager to robbing people in his own community, his really, really rich friends.
Westmont Village has its own private security patrol, as well as the Westmont Police Department. The crime rate is almost non-existent. You live in a place like that long enough, you start to feel insulated from the rest of the world. You get complacent about things like alarm systems and locking all your doors.
And he doesn't seem to struggle with this transition. Why do you think that is?
You know, I think he struggles with a lot of the logistics of said transition, but one of the taglines is you don't know what you're missing. And I think so much of what the show talks about is this ridiculously conspicuous consumption that we have, the stuff that these people have acquired, this ridiculous amount of, how many bags does a person need to be happy? How many watches does anybody really need? And as Coop finds out, you know, he thinks these people don't necessarily miss this stuff, but maybe they do. And he doesn't really realize what these people think of this. And it's a very interesting question that the show asks. Is this stuff really worth this amount of money?
I mean, I've definitely never had to put an alarm on one of my purses. Let's just say that.
You don't have a purse alarm?
I don't have a purse alarm. I feel like if you're carrying a purse, it should be protecting the money inside.
Exactly.
So he's not exactly Robin Hood, right? He's stealing from the rich, but he's doing it to maintain a similar lifestyle that he'd been living. So is Coop a good person?
That's the question, right? I think he's trying to find his way back into being a good person. And what does that entail, right? I think he is realizing that these interconnected decisions that he has made that has gotten him to this place in his life have been sometimes decisions that have been directed by the wrong motivations. What he realizes is that life is and should be more about the relationships that you have and maintain rather than necessarily the acquisition of so much material stuff.
In the process of this, you have a bond and partnership with Elena, the housekeeper of someone
in Coop's circle. And at one point, she tells him, when they're talking about what they're doing,
"You've never gone hungry. Your kids will never go hungry. You just want what they took from you because all you know how to be is rich.
Elena,
you have no idea what real struggle is, Coop."
That's a pretty significant moment, I think, both for Coop and for the show. And I think really establishing those two worlds as certainly involved with one another, but very separate. This is someone who is very much on the outside looking in, and for whom this generational wealth is decidedly life-changing, and it's treated by most of the other people in this story as a trifle.
Yeah. I mean, the sums of money that are thrown around as if it's just normal. Like, oh, we need $10,000 for this. We need $50,000 for this. And for this first time, Coop has to be like, wait a second, do I have that money?
Yeah. When you look at it in a pile and you say, this is what that money looks like.
Yeah.
It's sobering for sure.
Yeah. I mean, you work in an industry that beyond the work, the creative work that you do, has the trappings of luxury. You know, I just wonder how much you drew on people in your own life, your things you've come across in this industry that has that side of it.
Quite a bit. I mean, it's, you know, you don't have to look too far in Hollywood to realize that there's quite a few parallels to this world as well. But then you also see something like what happened in the Palisades and in Altadena and like that, it can all go away, you know, and just because people are wealthy or rich or well off or what have you, you know, doesn't make it any less devastating when they lose everything that they've worked in many cases a lifetime to achieve and that's meaningful to them in many ways. So there's two sides to every conversation for sure. But we kind of take a little more of a ironic look at it for sure.
And my last question, I mean, I was watching this and thinking there's a joy that people get in watching rich people fall apart, really. Why do you think that is?
You know, I think that rich people behaving badly seems to be getting their comeuppance seems to be a bit of a trend these days. And I think it has something to do with where we are culturally and certainly politically. When we see these people who are billionaires that are making decisions seemingly haphazardly about people's jobs and lifestyle and welfare, and there is something about the way certain rich people are behaving right now that makes us all really want them to have some sort of comeuppance. So maybe this will resonate with those people.
John Hamm, he's the star and executive producer of the new series, Your Friends and Neighbors. Thank you so much and congratulations.
Thank you very much. Lovely talking with you.
This is NPR News.
Are you a cat person or a dog person? Well, whatever your preference, the new documentary Pets explores what our relationship with animals says about being human.
There's a side of people that come out when they're talking about their pets that's very revealing.
I'm Juana Summers. My conversation with actress and documentary filmmaker Bryce Dallas Howard on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. President Trump is scheduled to get a physical today at Walter Reed Military Medical Center. NPR's Tamara Keith reports Trump will turn 79 years old in June and in the past hasn't shared a lot of details about his health.
President Trump last released detailed information about his health 5 years ago, though he put out a brief and positive summary during the campaign. Given his age and the focus on his predecessor's health while in office, the results of Trump's exam will get a lot of attention. S.J. Olshansky is a professor of public health at the University of Illinois Chicago who has studied the health of presidents.
There's very few people on the planet that are monitored as closely as U.S. presidents.
He says if everyone had access to health care like presidents do, it would have a pretty dramatic effect on life expectancy. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
The Republican-led Senate has voted to confirm the nation's next chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Air Force Lieutenant General Dan Kane is a former combat pilot who also worked as a liaison for the CIA. Kane is the first chairman to be nominated while retired and without prior four-star rank. He was nominated by President Trump after the abrupt dismissal of General C.Q. Brown. This is NPR News in Washington. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says his intelligence officials are aware of more than 150 Chinese nationals fighting for Russia. NPR's Joanna Kakissis reports Ukraine has captured two of those fighters in the eastern part of the country, where the Russian army is advancing.
Speaking to reporters in a closed briefing, Zelensky said he was not aware that China directly commanded the recruits to fight alongside Russian soldiers. He said, their motivation, money, politics, etc., it's not known yet, at least to me, but it will be known. Zelensky did suggest that China was not doing enough to discourage Chinese nationals from fighting for Russia during its three-year war on Ukraine. Beijing called Zelensky's remarks irresponsible. Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Lin Qian said China supports a peaceful end to the war. However, China has forged a no-limits partnership with Russia during the war. Joanna Kakissis, NPR News, Kyiv.
Electric vehicle maker Tesla has stopped accepting new orders in China for two car models that it imports from the United States. The move comes after the Chinese government announced 125% tariffs on the U.S. today. Stocks opened lower on Wall Street this morning. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 328 points, the Nasdaq down 77, the S&P 500 down 35 points. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America. From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. The Trump administration has ordered the National Institutes of Health to study the physical and mental health effects of undergoing gender transition. NPR health correspondent Rob Stein obtained an internal memo detailing that research plan.
According to the directive, the NIH plans to study the impact of, quote, social transition and or chemical and surgical mutilation, unquote, among children who transition. Specifically, the White House wants the NIH to study regret and detransition among children and adults who have transitioned. The plan is setting off alarm bells among many researchers and in the LGBTQ community.
What they're looking for is a political answer, not a scientific one.
Adrian Schenker was the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Health Policy at the Department of Health and Human Services under President Biden.
That should be an alarm for everyone who cares about the scientific integrity of National Institutes for Health.
Among the red flags in the directive, Schenker and others say, is the language. Harry Barbee is an assistant professor in the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health.
Chemical or surgical mutilation, you know, these are deeply offensive terms, and especially when referring to evidence-based medical interventions like puberty blockers, hormone therapy, or gender-affirming surgeries. This terminology has no place in serious scientific or public health discourse. The language has been historically used to stigmatize trans people. Even the phrase regret and detransition can be weaponized.
Many researchers say there is already a solid body of evidence that the level of regret after transition is very low. Lindsay Dawson directs LGBTQ health policy at KFF, a nonpartisan health research group.
Regret rates for gender-affirming care are about less than 1%, which is much lower than regret rates for procedures that we see as quite common and that are widely accepted.
Like hip replacements, obesity surgeries, and even tattoos. Dawson and others say they're not surprised by the directive, given the rhetoric Trump used during the campaign about trans people and other steps the administration has taken since coming into office, like the slashing of funding for hundreds of studies about important physical and mental health issues people in the LGBTQ community face. Brittany Charlton studies the LGBTQ community at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. She's been tracking these cancellations nationwide.
This is especially concerning given the recent defunding of probably hundreds of NIH-supported studies that focused on trans health. Having the NIH shift their focus, that really impedes our ability to actually understand the full picture.
Neither the NIH nor the Health and Human Services Department responded to NPR's request for comment, but others argue that previous research on trans regret was poorly done and is outdated. Yevgenia Abuzeza is the co-founder of the group Evidence-Based Gender Medicine.
We are starting to see much greater numbers of young people who are saying that they went down the wrong path for them and they're now left with irreversible changes to their body. And they no longer identify as transgender, but they are left with these permanent effects. There are a lot of negative impacts of transition, and regret is definitely one of them. It's a very important area of medicine to study.
The directive says that, quote, this is very important to the President and Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., and they would like the NIH to move as quickly as possible. Rob Stein, NPR News.
The Supreme Court says the Trump administration must, quote, facilitate the return of a Maryland man who was mistakenly deported to El Salvador.
The High Court mostly sided with a lower court judge despite an emergency appeal from the Trump administration. The justices sent the case back for clarification to that judge on just what the court can tell the president to do.
NPR's Joel Rose covers immigration, and he's with us now. Good morning, Joel.
Good morning, Michelle.
So if you would just remind us of who the man is at the center of this case.
His name is Kilmar Abrego Garcia, and he had been living in Maryland for over a decade. He had a form of protected status that should have prevented his deportation to El Salvador. In spite of that, ICE officers arrested Abrego Garcia last month and deported him to El Salvador, along with hundreds of other men that the Trump administration also accuses of being gang members. Abrego Garcia denies that. The government says he was deported to El Salvador because of an administrative error, but argued there is nothing it can do now because Abrego Garcia was already out of the U.S. A federal district judge rejected that argument. She ordered that he be brought back to Maryland quickly. But Chief Justice John Roberts put that order on hold while the Supreme Court could consider the case.
And what exactly did the Supreme Court decide last night?
The court issued a brief unsigned order. It's interesting to note that there were no dissents, although there was a statement from Justice Sonia Sotomayor, joined by the court's other two liberals, calling this an egregious violation of Abrego Garcia's rights. The court said that the government must now facilitate Abrego Garcia's release from custody in El Salvador and handle his case as it would have been handled if he had not been improperly sent there. That part is a win for Abrego Garcia, but the justices also had some instructions for the district court judge. They told her to clarify the meaning of the word effectuate when she ordered the Trump administration to effectuate Abrego Garcia's return. The justices said the scope of that term is unclear and that it might exceed the lower court's authority when it comes to foreign policy.
So when do we expect that judge to act?
She already has. Late last night, Judge Paula Zinnis issued a new revised order clarifying that the government needs to take, quote, all steps to facilitate the return of Abrego Garcia, unquote, to the U.S. as soon as possible. Zinnis wants to know his current physical location and status, what steps the government has taken to bring him back, and what additional steps they are considering. And she's called a hearing for later today in Maryland. So Judge Zinnis is not wasting any time.
Has the White House said anything about this? Have they had any comment?
White House Deputy Chief of Staff Stephen Miller did post about the case on social media last night. He framed this as a rejection of the judge's order because the Supreme Court said that lower courts cannot dictate foreign policy. Miller claimed that it is El Salvador that is holding Abrego Garcia, not the U.S. government. So at this moment, it is not clear exactly when or if Abrego Garcia will be coming back to the U.S.
Before we let you go, there's another closely watched immigration case that's back in court today in Louisiana. So what can you tell us about that?
Yeah, this is the case of Mahmoud Khalil, the Columbia graduate student and lawful permanent resident who was arrested and detained by ICE last month because of his pro-Palestinian activism. Here, the Trump administration has argued that Khalil has engaged in, quote, anti-Semitic and destructive protests. And for that, he should be stripped of his green card and deported. His lawyer says that's a violation of the First Amendment, and the immigration judge says she'll decide today whether there's enough evidence to deport him or not.
That is NPR's Joel Rose. Joel, thank you.
You're welcome.
This is NPR News.
A theater in Washington, D.C. hosts a fun mock trial every year. It's where judges, lawyers, and Supreme Court justices trade topical jokes. Next time, here and now.
Big news stories don't always break on your schedule. But with the NPR app, news, culture, and podcasts are ready when you want them. In your pocket. Download the NPR app today.
Good morning, I'm Steve Inskeep. KFC announced a new offering, fried chicken flavored toothpaste. Brushing your teeth with 11 herbs and spices may sound enticing, but it came out April 1st and sounded like a gag. KFC said it wasn't. They listed the toothpaste and a matching toothbrush on the website, and both sold out. KFC has yet to provide one vital piece of information. How many dentists out of five recommend it? It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Ooma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business, With an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere at uma.com/NPR. And from Moderna, committed to protecting people from COVID-19, the CDC recommends getting a second dose of this season's COVID-19 vaccine for those 65 and older. Doctors can advise about getting a second dose. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. The world of big-time college athletics is about to change. Starting this fall, colleges and universities will be able to pay players directly for the first time, that is, if a major legal settlement is approved as expected. That means schools have some big decisions to make over the next few months. NPR sports correspondent Becky Sullivan is with us now to tell us more about this. Good morning, Becky.
Good morning.
So the biggest change coming this fall is what's essentially a salary cap for schools of up to $20 million to pay players. At least that's where it starts.
Yep.
How's that going to work?
Yeah, this is the big question. I think there's a lot of things for schools to consider. Take an athletic program like Ohio State. This is one of the biggest in the country. I spoke to their athletic director, Ross Bjork. He says there's an effort to make sure that a portion of the money is distributed evenly to male and female athletes to satisfy any Title IX concerns that might require proportionality there. But most of the money will be allocated based on a sport's market power. And so for many big-time programs like Ohio State, that, of course, means football. The Buckeyes just won the national title this past January. Here's how Ross Bjork put it to me.
Those of us that have a robust football program, you know, and a big brand like Ohio State football, we have to feed that. That's the economic engine that drives the rest of our 35 sports. We have 36 sports. 35 of them, even men's basketball to some degree, relies on the economic success of football.
Okay, so what does that mean? Like, how might that break down?
Yeah, he says Ohio State is still sorting that out, but I have seen some other estimates floating around for other schools allocating maybe 70-75% of the money to football players, the rest of it, most of the rest of it to men's basketball, some to women's basketball, maybe a little bit to baseball. For most schools, that is in alignment with which sports are bringing in how much revenue.
And look, you just told us Ohio State is one of the biggest athletic programs in the country.
Yep.
Okay. But what about smaller schools?
Yeah. So for a lot of these smaller schools that are outside sort of what are known as the Power Four conferences, have to choose whether to opt into the settlement, basically sign on to get to distribute some of that, you know, $20 million revenue share money. Dozens so far have announced that they're going to. So we're talking programs like UC San Diego, Youngstown State, Grand Canyon University. They don't have to pay out that full $20 million, but they can, you know, they can if they want. And that presents some interesting questions. Think basketball schools like Gonzaga or St. John's. They don't have football teams. That kind of money goes a lot further when your main focus is a 15-person men's basketball team, not a much, much bigger football team. So maybe there's a competitive advantage there as a result. We'll just have to see.
Okay, so another big change that you've been telling us about with this settlement is the introduction of roster limits to college sports.
Yep.
How will that work?
Yeah. So just to give some background, college sports traditionally manages team sizes with a limit on scholarships. You could have as many players on the team as you wanted if some didn't have scholarships or if they, you know, you split scholarships between multiple people. But under this legal settlement, schools will be able to give as many scholarships as they want. On the other hand, teams would now be subject to a roster size limit. So to stick with Ohio State, they say they're adding more than 90 new scholarships, a few to football, but mostly to other sports. That's good. On the other hand, the roster limits mean a bunch of their teams will shrink. Ultimately, they could lose around 10% of their total athlete number. That's a lot, mostly coming out of teams like rowing, swimming, and track and field. Now, the settlement isn't finalized yet. Some of that roster limit stuff could change, but it is significant.
So what other changes could be coming?
Well, schools are hoping this legal settlement brings some stability to college sports, which have had a lot of changes over these last few years brought about by lawsuits. So a lot of big-time college athletics officials were in Washington this past week to lobby Congress to pass legislation that shields the NCAA and all of college sports from future lawsuits and other legal issues coming down the road.
That is NPR's Becky Sullivan. Becky, thank you.
You're welcome.
This is NPR News. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. We have some news for seasonal allergy sufferers. Climate change is making for longer and more intense pollen seasons, which means more severe symptoms for those with allergies. Here's NPR's Maria Godoy.
Back when she was in her first year of medical school at George Washington University, Alicia Prashad would shadow other doctors at the ear, nose, and throat clinic. She quickly noticed a trend among hay fever sufferers.
I would hear people in clinic talk about how their symptoms have been getting worse. It was a very common complaint that I saw firsthand. And more importantly, I saw how much it impacted those patients' quality of life,
including missed days of school and work. Prashad wanted a better understanding of just how climate change was affecting what she was seeing in the clinic. So she and her colleagues reviewed dozens of studies looking at the impact of climate change on seasonal allergies around the globe. The review appears in the journal The Laryngoscope.
We are seeing that with rising global temperatures as a result of climate change, that pollen seasons are lengthening. So they are starting earlier and ending later.
For example, one study found the pollen season had already gotten 20 days longer in North America between 1990 and 2018. Another study projected that by the end of the century, warming temperatures would bring blooms as many as 40 days sooner in the spring and keep weeds and grasses releasing pollen up to 19 days later in the fall. Several studies also found an increase in the average daily concentration of pollen, which might not surprise those of us used to seeing our cars coated in yellow dust at this time of year.
And we are also seeing that with those rising temperatures, things like ragweed pollen are growing faster and growing more. And so the presence of that pollen is more abundant.
All of which means more misery for those with pollen allergies.
They're having more symptoms, earlier symptoms, and worse symptoms.
Research also shows the number of people with seasonal allergies is rising, and they're visiting the doctor more. One study found people in the U.S. spend $3.4 billion each year on medical costs for things like prescription medications and outpatient visits. Prashad says all this research brings home just how many ways climate change can affect our daily lives. Not to mention our sinuses. Maria Godoy, NPR News.
So we just got through March Madness. How about April Mallets? The Annapolis Cup is the biggest croquet contest in the United States, and every year it pits St. John's College, known as the Great Book School, against its neighbor and seeming polar opposite, the U.S. Naval Academy. NPR's Frank Langfitt reports from Annapolis, Maryland.
So there are three matches going on simultaneously on this big green lawn surrounded by red brick Georgian buildings here at the St. John's College campus. Oh. And the Navy team, they're dressed in white cardigans and black bow ties.
St. John's team are wearing homemade green tunics covered with blades of fake grass that resemble a croquet lawn. In croquet, players use a wooden mallet to knock balls through a course of metal hoops or wickets. St. John's Stephen Kendall provides play-by-play, describes a long-range shot by a fellow teammate.
Isaac has managed to go from wicket two to wicket three and then taken a shot, sort of a Hail Mary shot as it were, from wicket three to center.
How far is that? How many feet?
I want to say it's about 25 feet.
That's a long way in a sport where players usually aim for a wicket from no more than 5 feet away. If this all sounds confusing, you're not alone. Many in the audience say they can't follow the action either, which is fine because the Annapolis Cup is about more than croquet. Part of the appeal is a contest between such different institutions. Students at St. John's, known as Johnnies, they study writings from some of the world's greatest thinkers, from Aristotle to James Baldwin. Navy's midshipmen, known as middies, focus on subjects like electrical engineering and submarine warfare.
My name is Sean Callahan, Naval Chemist class of 1985, and I was the captain of the inaugural team back in 1983.
Callahan says when the tradition began, people compared the Annapolis Cup to a contest between ancient Athens and Sparta.
The Spartans are the gladiators, and it's might makes right, and it's force, and it's war. Whereas Athens was the philosophical nature of how do we figure out mathematics and how people think.
Beyond the competition, this is a sprawling lawn party that draws thousands to kick off spring in this former British colonial city along the Chesapeake Bay. There's a Navy mariachi band knocking out a Frankie Valli tune. Later, men in boaters and bow ties dance with women in sundresses to a jazz band in a scene that could be out of The Great Gatsby. The Annapolis Cup began more than four decades ago, after a St. John's freshman challenged Navy in hopes of creating an old-fashioned college rivalry. But St. John's Croquet Club was not really prepared. John Ertle, the team captain, remembers.
The croquet club at that time was an excuse to get $50 to buy beer from the college every year.
Sean Callahan, Navy's croquet captain, he recalls how quickly that changed.
When we accepted the challenge, they all of a sudden got motivated. They're like, we're going to take down these big, giant jocks. And they wiped the floor with us.
Decades later, the Annapolis Cup is an institution. Elad Nicholas Kaufman is covering today's match for the St. John's newspaper.
I think it's a really lovely place for two very different schools to come together and realize we're not so different after all. We're nerdy in our own ways. We're, you know, very interested in the careful tactics of croquet, and we like to come together as a community.
After about 5 hours of croquet, Navy pulled off the upset. Afterwards, both teams gathered on the pitch and sang traditional school songs. It was Navy's ninth win to St. John's 32nd, which, of course, is not what this event is really about. Frank Langford, NPR News, Annapolis.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Our theme music is inspired by B.J. Lederman. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
I met a gal in a mining town. Her hair was black and her eyes was brown. She made my heart go round and round while we danced the night away. All night they played the sweetest music. Played the sweetest music that's been heard this side of paradise. There was coal dust on the fiddle. Coal dust on the fiddle and stardust in her lovely eyes. Next day we met at the general store. She sure did things to a pin out for. And then we went and kissed.